What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week and do some advanced reviews, which we'll get into for in a moment. But first, let's kick it off with some big, big books that came out this week. First one, Bloodhunt.
Bang! Big
bang,
ones.
Bang, 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 big books, as we always say on the show. Bloodhunt, number one from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Pepe Larraz. This is the kickoff to a huge event that Jed McKay has been seeding through various titles for, I think, a year now, I want to say. Additionally, there's been a bunch of tee-ups that have happened in other books over the past couple of weeks that you might have seen. But it all comes to bear here, and it's going to spin out into so many spinoffs. So many one-shots and specials and mini-series. I just want to say up front, we've done things sometimes where we do like mini-series where we're like, we're going to read every title of this and review it of the week. I don't think I could do that with Bloodhunt.
Really? You can't handle the blood? You
don't I can't handle 12 to 20 titles a week. That's a lot. That's a lot of titles coming out like in a solid week. So I was very, I would say, apprehensive getting in here because I was like, I sort of hope I hate this so that I don't feel bad about not reading every single Bloodhunt title that's coming out. And then, god damn it, it's good.
It's honestly, I thought this was great.
Yeah.
First off, just the Pepe Larraz art is so good. Like, it is really beautiful.
Oh, can I interrupt with something real quick? Just a point of clarification here for anybody going to the comic book store. So there are two versions of Bloodhunt. There's the regular version of Bloodhunt, and then there's the Red Band adults-only version that has a extra six pages that are too bloody to be released digitally or anything like that. We are reviewing the regular issue of Bloodhunt. We are not reviewing.
But I'm going to go get that red band and I'm going to get fucking weird as soon as I get it in my hands, you know?
I kind of am. I enjoyed this enough that I'm like 100% going to definitely pick up the red band version because I'm curious how much more extreme it get. But go ahead, Justin, please.
It'll be a great point of comparison to make, I think, because I think, aren't they doing a red band for a couple of these?
Just the main series.
Yeah.
And then after that, there's a, I want to say Jack Russell Terrier, Werewolf by Night series is going to be red band as well. But that's after Bloodhunt is over.
I think that's a great idea for just a good, a smart and very corporate way of them being like, how can we make a little bit more money? We can sell a fucked up version of it.
Well, and also drive foot traffic to comic book stores as well, which I think is very laudable. So there you go. But let's get back to the book proper. And I just want to put a spoiler warning here because there's at least one enormous thing that we definitely have to talk about with this book. But take away with overall thoughts first.
I really enjoyed it. I love the sort of big event-based start that the book has, that all the Darkhold characters are Darkhold is the book. Dark Force is the
yes. They mentioned both in this comic.
Oh, and honestly, the whole time I'm reading this, I'm thinking Darkhold Redeemers is a two word phrase in my head, which was a comic in the 90s. I want to say that was like it had, I think, Blade, Brother Voodoo. I want to say like all the characters who are like we are on the fringes of magic and stuff. Anyway, they had to collect the pages of a book. Very, like, librarian-style task. But so when the Dark Force characters explode, that was a really cool, interesting way to do it. I love the – Jed McKay loves the characters that he writes. And so we get some Tigra stuff and Hunter's Moon. I really like that. When we reveal the villains – I was like, oh, these remind me of the Avengers villains.
Yes, that was another thing going into this. So it's this new villain team called the Blood Coven, which is a bunch of superpowered vampires who are attacking the Avengers. Hearing that, going into this event, again, like we talked about with the Ashen Combine, I was like, stop trying to remake the Black Order. That barely worked when Jonathan Hickman did it.
Yeah.
Please don't do it again. But again, I kind of like these vampires. Like, they're really fucked up they do and very specific the way that they do it.
I love the way it's simultaneously, it's like, How do they get so powerful? They drank superhero blood. It's like, oh, cool. And then it's like, also, they got weird with their what they drink. They drink ghosts. I was like, whoa, they drink ghosts. I've definitely felt like Shaggy.
That's the big thing about this is like, this is fun as harrowing things are happening to our heroes and absolutely awful things are happening to the Avengers in particular by the end of the book. It's very funny, as the best Jed McKay books are. There's a great exchange between Iron Man and Scarlet Witch right at the top of the book, where Iron Man is like, Scarlet Witch, can you use your chaos magic power? And she's like, I don't know. Can you use your iron suit powers, asshole, to do it? So much fun. That's great. Everything that goes on with the Blood Coven is great. All the Blade stuff throughout the book is so badass. The thing when he calls up the Avengers is like, and they're like, hello, who is this? And he's like, exactly who you want it to be.
I know.
Like, hell yeah.
Well, the way Blade has been, and since he's been sort of more centralized in the Avengers and stuff in the last few years, he is like the guy who's like, ha, I'm here, you know? And it's very funny. And Jed does it well here. And, you know, there is a big reveal at the end that I thought was well done. I feel like it's written in such a way where you sense it a second before it's revealed, which is... That's really hard to do. Obviously, a reveal that is a surprise is fun, but this is like horror movie timing, where you know the bad thing's happening a second before it happens, so you can be like sort of almost scared twice, or it builds your anticipation so much. Very well done here, I think.
And I know we're dancing around the spoiler here. I don't know if we should specifically talk about it or not, but I will say it is very rare to be this surprised at the end of a book, particularly... Marvel has put out so many press releases, so much preview material about months of this Bloodhound thing. The fact that I did not see coming what happens at the end of this book, very impressive.
Especially when usually at the end of these first issue of a crossover, it's like, surprise, it's Thanos. It's like, of course it's Thanos. Like, what are you talking about? Get out of here with that reveal. This reveal works. And, you know, it's funny. I was thinking a lot about the DC Vampire series. And I had to actually look it up, and I was like, oh, DC versus Vampire. Right? Pretty easy. Should have known that. But that was like these two events are like opposites. That event was like trickle building to like a huge event. This is the opposite. It's like huge, big bombshells that I think now we're going to get the trickle out. Certainly some superheroes are going to get turned, I would think. There's going to be like different deaths / not quite deaths, undeaths. It's really, really nice, really smart way to not do the same thing.
Totally. I am way more stoked for this book coming out of it than I was going in, which is a great place to be. Let's talk about another big event.
Which I'm reading all of them, Alex, and so are you.
Oh, my God. Are we doing that on the podcast? Are we going to have our...
Yes, I guess.
Hunt for Blood Hunt? Yeah, I guess we have to do that. You know who's going to love that? Pete, who's not here. Superman, House of Brainiac special number one from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson. He's going to have some weird problem. He's like, I don't like teeth. Based events.
And honestly, he probably has a weird thing with teeth.
Yeah. Written by Joshua Williamson and Mark Russell, art by Steve Pugh, Edwin Galman, and Fico Asio. This is telling a couple of stories around the House of Brainiac event, but this is a vital book if you're reading it. And not only that, it's a vital book in terms of the tapestry of the DC universe, which I was very surprised about. We get a reveal about Brainiac and his whole histories with the Sarnians, which are Lobos, basically. We also get a huge reveal about who has been behind Amanda Waller the entire time. But I got to tell you, and I know I'm a sucker for this, the middle story from Mark Russell and Steve Pugh, where it's Bibbo Babowski and the chief, why am I blanking his name?
Perry White.
Perry White, running for mayor.
The chief. Whoa, chief. What are you talking about? I don't know.
It's been a long night already. Perry White running for mayor, just great. Just
I mean, same. Like, I all these stories are great, but the Bibbo, there's something about Bibbo. I forget how important Bibbo was for the death of Superman in those years. He was like sort of the heart of the book. Weirdly, you know, Superman's usually the heart of his book, but for a while, Bibbo was like right there. And so then to see him again and sort of referencing that in the past is just really nice. I like Bibbo. I thought this story was great. It definitely has the sort of boots on the ground, beating heart going on.
But it's also just great bits from Mark Russell and Steve Pugh. The whole idea that Bibbo is running a bar that up until noon is the Perry White headquarters, and then it turns into a bar, and they keep playing that. Very fun. All the social media stuff, like Lex Luthor just putting like a interesting like Elon Musk in there. It's just all like, it's very hard to feel present with a comic book, and that's exactly what this does. Good stuff. Space Ghost, number one from Dynamite, written by David Popoz, art by Jonathan Lau. If you haven't, go listen to our interview with David from the live show a couple of weeks back, where he talked about the book.
We should ask him about
Don't do that. Don't do that. He's not here. You don't have to do that.
Sorry, I eat ghosts and I ate Pete's ghost.
You ate Pete's ghost. Okay, fair enough. Space Ghost. This is finally out, so we can talk about it. David, as he mentioned on the book, noted that this is a more serious take on Space Ghost than what they did over on Adult Swim, which is probably what you're most familiar with. And it really pays off here with a pretty intense Space Ghost fighting a really villainous Brack and protecting two kids and a monkey. There's some good emotion in here. There's some badass action sequences from Jonathan Lau. This is another one we talked about on the live show. But like Space Ghost just emerging from shadow, that was definitely the moment where I flipped the page and I was like, this is a cool book.
Well, and it's very smartly done. Like, knowing that Space Ghost Coast to Coast is what people know of Space Ghost. I mean, like, how can we reintroduce this character and not have it be bits? Mm-hmm. And the way that the perspective, like we see him first emerge from shadow and we're not ever in his head, we're just watching him be badass, is so smart to show us that. It's sort of very much a page one, like watch him do stuff. We see his different powers at play. You see his sort of grim visage telling people what's up. Like, it's just a good, it makes Space Ghost a good superhero story.
I'm really excited to follow this going forward, particularly because of the emotional hook of the two kids that he needs to take care of.
And the monkey.
Yeah, and the monkey. Yeah, I guess that's fine. But mostly the kids. I think, like, they're a good window character into this weird guy who is a white-suited space Batman, but not really at all. So, I don't know. I'm excited to follow this book.
How does he keep those spandex clean?
In space?
In space?
There's a lot of dust. There's dust in there.
Space, no one can hear you clean.
Get Fury. Somebody call Ridley Scott. Get Ridley Scott. Number one from Marvel. Written by Garth Ennis. Art by Jason Burroughs. This is going back in the day, taking place after the classic Punisher Born Again storyline. Nick Fury has been captured in Vietnam. Punisher needs to go after him to kill him, of course, because he's the Punisher. Also, to be clear, he's not Punisher yet. He's Lieutenant Frank.
Captain Castle.
He's Captain Regular Castle. Guy. There you go. But this is exactly what you expect from this book. You know what you're getting into here. It's Garth Ennis. It's Jason Burroughs. It's violent. It's bloody. There's a lot of very technical war stuff going on. These guys know their way around this, and they continue to crush that. You seem maybe to take a contrary point.
Well, only on the, like, you know what you're getting out of this, because I was like, ooh, Get Fury. That's going to be cool. A Nick Fury story. And then immediately it's just, hey, Punisher's doing stuff. I was like, okay. And it's very good. It's just Fury is
there in the last scene, which is the gruesome, bloody scene that you expect from this book, which is kind of held off on most of the book. Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what to say about this other than, like, Garth Ennis probably writes war books better than anybody else, so.
Well, yes, and it is good. It has the, like, you know, war slice of life moments that are so good and unique. And at the same time, all the blood and Frank Castle being the proto-Punisher in a way that is, like, more badass. He's very badass without the sort of weird part of he wears spandex and
has guns. What do you think? Do you think the Punisher is going to kill Nick Fury by the end of the series?
Interesting claim. Interesting question. I would think no. They're like, the government's like, you got to go kill Nick Fury. He knows too much. And Punisher's like, can we save him? And they're like, no way. That would be impossible unless. And it's like, got it. That's what we're going to do. You can save Nick Fury if you kill everyone else there. Like, no problem. Mission accepted.
Yes. Good stuff. Crave number 6 from Image Comics by Maria Lovett. This is the final issue of this title about a evil app that is making everybody have sex with each other on campus.
Yeah, it's called Instagram, Alex. Hello. Get out of here.
I was like, there's a joke percolating in the back of my head. Oh, Justin.
You did all the work. I just said it. You did all the work.
Anyway, this is the last issue here. I think we generally have really liked Maria Lovett's art throughout the series. I know you've been very high on it in terms of its mix between sci-fi concepts and sexuality. But how do you think this wrapped up?
I do. I really like this book. I thought it was great. I think this issue felt a little like the big stuff happened last issue, mm-hmm. and this is sort of just like a gentle laydown of all of our characters finishing up. So, like, I sort of wish this issue and the last issue were combined into one or mm-hmm. shaken up a little bit so there was some more stuff happening here. But the art's great. The story up until now is really good, harrowing, sexy. Like, it has all these the sex part that I feel like the book is sort of being sold on is met by the story and the sort of thriller part of it based on this, you know, scary app situation. It's just this last issue, I feel like.
No, I agree with you, but I would actually extend it past or before this last issue a little bit. I like this book in general. Really like Maria Lovett's art. I think there's some interesting things being said here. The ultimate thing that I think she's going for is, can we make connections outside of technology and what happens when we're forced into those situations? So I like that theme. But pacing-wise, it started to fizzle out about halfway through for me, where things started to get wilder and wilder, and then they just sort of settled into conversations. So I don't know. There was something, again, a little bit off about the pace on this, but generally I thought this was a well-done book. And there's a tease that she's going to be doing another book coming up, so excited to check that out. She's an interesting creator. Harley Quinn 2024 Annual Number 1 from DC Comics by Erica Henderson. This is one of my most anticipated issues of the week. As Harley Quinn goes on a cruise, Zatanna is there and they need to solve a murder mystery. This is exactly what I wanted out of this. This is Erica Henderson, who drew Skrull Girl, writing some ridiculous situations with Harley and Zatanna. There is a very goofy bit at the beginning with a calzone. The whole idea that Harley does a crime that is really under the radar, so she does it successfully and gets a lot of money, is just a very good joke given all of Gotham City. And Harley and Zatanna are two good, fun characters to work together. Spoiler here, but they also end up on the cruise with Vandal Savage. So just as a trio, it's ridiculous. It's goofy. Erica Henderson knows how to draw this stuff. I had a good time.
Same. The when Vandal Savage just sort of leans over and says, I'm here. I was like, yeah, of course he is. He's hanging out. Only after they say his name is he like, hello. Did somebody say Vandal? Killer name for any child. If anyone's out there looking for a name for your kid, Vandal. Vandal Higginbottom.
There you go. Good stuff.
This is what annuals should be. Like, mm-hmm. turning it over to a great creator to do something a little bit different. I think annuals should either be paying off another story as the final expanded double-sized climax, say, or it should be something that's a little bit of a swing, and this feels like what that is. I thought it was great. Let's have all annuals be like this.
Yeah, just while we're talking about our philosophy on annuals, first of all, I think they should come out in a concentrated period of time. And I really like the crossover thing. Like, Marvel is about to go into this whole Infinity Watch crossover with their annuals. That's great. And granted, I'm a sucker for things from back in the day, like Atlantis Attacks and whatever else. I used to love that. But I agree with you on this bent, where if you're not going to go the crossover route, just make it like an oversized special about the character and make it super fun and unique. And there you go.
Vibranium Vendetta is what you're
talking about. Vibranium Vendetta, yes. Deadpool, Wolverine, World War III, number one from Marvel, written by Joe Kelly, art by Adam Kubert. If you're stoked about the movie, get ready for Deadpool and Wolverine to take on a guy with glowing tentacles and then Deadpool to wear a helmet and a bunch of other stuff going on. Things that I'm sure we will all see on screen. This is Joe Kelly, who is very well known for doing Deadpool, writing a
He's known as the guy that made Deadpool funny.
Yeah. And Adam Kubert, of course, iconic artist. Yeah. This is way weirder than I expected, to the point that I was like, is this Joe Kelly or Joe Casey? Because I feel like this is Joe Casey, but it's not. Well, it's Kelly.
Plus, are we talking about a Joe Casey book later on the stack?
Yes, we are.
Especially, I was like, wow, these guys, did they switch places briefly? But I still really enjoy this. I like that it was weirder than it needed to be or than we expected, because it was still very fun. We got some great jokes in here. The art is fantastic. It feels like classic Marvel comics from, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, where these guys are teaming up. Neither of them really wants to do it, and then things go wrong. A lot of Wolverine being grizzly.
Great Deadpool jokes throughout here, too. Like, Joe Kelly really, really hits the humor. So if you're looking for that, I think it'll scratch that itch. Lester of the Lesser Gods, number one from Dark Horse Comics, written by Eric Powell and Lucky Yates, art by Gideon Kendall. Little note here, before we even get into reviewing the book, full creative team is going to be on our live show next week, so check that out. But this is a spinoff of their self-released book about the son of Odin who is going on quests in a post-apocalyptic world. It reminded me a bunch of, what was the book by Chip Zdarsky that was basically Masters of the Universe?
Captara.
It reminded me of Captara a little bit. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's goofy and funny post-apocalyptic stuff. There's gross action throughout. I enjoyed this. I had a good time.
This reminded me of Gru, if Gru was targeted to, a little bit older people. It's fun. There's some great jokes in here also. I liked the post-up. We start with a sort of cyborg narrator talking about how I can tell by those loafers and zebra print jam shorts, you must be from the people of the Mart of K from over the mountains of Dew. That's fun.
Yeah. It's good. It's a jokey book. It's a comedy book. If that's what you're looking for, definitely check this out. With some great art by Gideon Kendall as well. I really like the character designs. And, kind of the joke is that he is a overweight Conan the Barbarian type, but they don't play into that joke too much, which I appreciated. Yeah. So it's top of your intelligence, even if as it's low humor.
And it feels like it's a little bit lighter than The Goon. It's not nearly as sort of rooted in the miseries of life. It's just going for the fun of it. So that's a fun place to be for these guys.
Let's talk about an advance review. Blood Squad 7, number one. This is coming out May 22nd. This is from Image Comics, written by, as mentioned earlier, as cleverly teased, Joe Casey. Art by Paul Fry. Now, there's an interesting genesis for this book that I'll get into here that I'll admit I was not completely familiar with, but
Same. The
idea here is Joe Casey has been having discussions with Eric Stevenson about the anniversary of Image Comics, and he was like, what if we do something revisiting one of our iconic teams and figure out what it would be like for them 30 years later? Here's the thing that I didn't know. This is public knowledge. This is not anything that is secret, but I just missed this somehow. In 2019, Rob Liefeld revealed that he does not have the rights to Youngblood and has not had them for about 20 years at this point. So anytime there is a Youngblood title that has been pushed, he has tried to be a good Samaritan, a good neighbor, and be like, yay, Youngblood. I love the Youngblood. Let's go. Here's a new Youngblood title. But in 2019, he got kind of fed up and he was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. This is not my stuff. This is not what I created. And that was the original Image Comics team. For this new book, It seems like what they wanted to do was a Youngblood title that satirically looks back on it 30 years later. What would it be like looking at these celebrity superheroes now that we're three decades on? But they didn't want to use Youngblood because they didn't want to give the rights holders the money and et cetera. So that's pretty wild backstory for here.
Yeah.
What we actually get is the super team that basically is Youngblood coming
back.
They're
even in the Youngblood poses.
Exactly. Being brought back again, but in a new mode. Justin, what did you think about this one? Were you a Youngblood guy back in the day?
I mean, if you were reading comics back then, the anticipation of the launch of Image Comics with Youngblood number one, I was painting a fence in the summer that it took like a long time. It was a wrought iron fence.
You were Tom Sawyer back in the day, right?
Sort of, in a way. Yeah. I didn't trick anybody into doing it for me, unfortunately. But all my brother and I were doing it. All we talked about was how we had ordered the Image Comics to be shipped to us. And were they going to come that day? And it turns out we were off by like a full 2 months. They came like at the end. It was horrible. Every day the mailbox is empty. But it was all anticipation. And honestly, when it came, I was like, this is badass. This is amazing. You know, looking back on it, there's not much story there. It's a great idea. But the actual comic is a lot of just featuring Rob Liefeld's art in a way that is awesome. And that was like the biggest thing in the world then. This, I think, gets more into the thematic stuff. The stuff that when Ecstatics or an X-Force came out and the Ecstatics team took it over, Rob Liefeld was like, we did this media commentary, you know, back in Youngblood. And I was like, I don't remember media commentary when I was reading this as a teenager. But this feels like it is actually doing that. And it feels like it is updating it to what the modern world is like, where there's just a darker timbre on all of this stuff.
The one qualm I have about this, which is not their fault, I think Joe Casey, great writer, knows what he's doing, is good with satire and the media and whatever else. Paul Fry drawing some really good characters, some badass action sequences. There's a great ending here that really leaves you on a big cliffhanger. But in terms of this idea, you mentioned Ecstatics. It's already being done. Like, and it's already been done a bunch of times. The one that I would call out is Local Man, that I think from Image Comics is doing a better job right now. And granted, this is only one issue that hasn't come out yet, but it's doing a better job of deconstructing the 90s era of Image Comics than Blood Squad 7 is one issue out of the gate. So we'll see where it goes. I'll still
read this. Well, let me say this. I hear what you're saying. I think Local Man is lovingly talking about the Image Comics of the 90s from a grounded character point of view. This feels like almost the opposite. It's being critical of that a little bit from a much wider lens team perspective, sort of more in the premise and ideas. So maybe we'll get more into the characters and we can sort of dip into that, but that's definitely not where it's starting.
All right, fair enough. From that nostalgia, let's go to some more nostalgia. Star Wars Episode One: The Phantom Menace Anniversary Special, number one from Marvel, written by Greg Pak, art by Will Sliney. This is weaving through the raindrops of the Phantom Menace to tell us his tale of Anakin Skywalker and his mom, Shmi Skywalker.
Beautifully named. Kids can't fault Lucas for naming Shmi.
Here's the thing. This is a bad movie that I saw four times in the theaters and I've seen multiple times since.
What did you learn on the fourth screening of Phantom Menace?
Did you think I should stop seeing Phantom Menace in the theaters. But, and I'm still like, it's going back in theaters. I'm like, I don't know. I had a good time. Maybe I should go see it in theaters again, which is straight up Stockholm Syndrome. But I do think writers like Greg Pak are doing a bang up job of looking at, like, what is the actual idea here of what George Lucas was trying to do with these things, or maybe could have done with these things, and how can we reclimate it in some way and turn it into something that has some sort of emotional resonance? And that's definitely, I think, what this team does here, because you can feel the flat, terrible delivery of Shmi Skywalker in every single page that she shows up in this book that is consistent with what happens in the comic book. But at the same time, Greg Pak takes the entire span of the story of the Phantom Menace and weaves it into a story of Anakin Skywalker that is really sad by the end. I was expecting to like this, frankly, because I know Greg Pak knows what he's doing with this stuff, but I was really bowled over with what he did here.
Agree, because when I was like, this is a story about Anakin and his mom, I was like, oh, that's like the double black diamond of making a story good. Because that story is bad.
Yeah.
Especially the way it ends. It's awful. It's like such, it's like being hit with a cold hammer, the way that it is played in the movies. And it just sucks. So the fact that Greg Pak was able to find a way to not touch those, the third rail of all of that bad storytelling, and still make a story that was surprising and sweet at points. Even Jar Jar is sort of like telling us what's up. In a way, I was like, wow, really nailed that. I just thought the ending was great.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I think like we've seen this with a lot of Greg Pak books. We've seen this with a lot of Charles Soule Star Wars books as well. I almost feel like they take it as a challenge in a certain way. Like,
definitely.
This was bad. How can I make this good? Like, how can I plus this up a little bit and figure out what they meant to do here, but completely 100% missed? So if you have any nostalgia about The Phantom Menace, if you hated The Phantom Menace in equal portion, I think this is worth picking up because this is a very heartfelt story. So there you go.
It's also funny the way that Greg writes this, where he's like, and Anakin did the impossible by accident. Again. It's like, yeah, it is crazy when you see all the things he does much closer together than in the movie, even when he accidentally saves the day when he's flying through space. Shmi, goodbye. Good night, Shmi.
Let's move on to something that is not nostalgic, but actually extremely heady. The Flash 24-24, annual number one from DC Comics, written by Cy Spurrier, art by Scott Koblish, Amon K. Nahuelpen, George Kambadias, and Tom Derenick. This is basically the diametric opposite of the Harley Quinn annual, because this is heavily tied to what is going on in The Flash. Wally West is missing. He is traveling with a weird silver lady through various dimensions, trying to catch beings called the Stillness. Meanwhile, Barry Allen is back on Earth, and something is extremely wrong with him that he is grappling with. Meanwhile, all the Flash villains are in the background, kind of doing their own thing and trying to destroy all the Flashes. Plus, Amanda Waller shows up. So much is going on in the book, but man, I appreciate this book just on the level of it intellectually engaging me. I know I've talked about this on the podcast before, but like, there's some books that you're like, yep, flipping through it, read it, here we go.
Got it.
Flash is like, I need to stare at every page and read every word and make sure that I understand what's going on.
Because it's the Shogun of comics.
Right, yes. Now. Great call. It's so intricate.
Yeah. And I really like it, though. I like that it's really breaking down the Flashes, something that really never happens. Bad things happen to the Flashes all the time, but rarely are they meticulously disassembled in this way. They're smashed. We're smashing the Flash right here.
And
Flash smash. It's really, really well done because of the high physics way that it's being done. And it feels like we know the problem, even though we don't yet. Storytelling wise, we don't know the answer, but it feels like it's right on the fringe. It's like right at the end of our vision, and we can't quite turn our head fast enough to see it. And I love that feeling when I'm reading something.
Plus the art. I mean, this is such a phenomenal art team throughout this book. Every single page looks absolutely amazing. There are wild creatures throughout. Great stuff. If you haven't been reading The Flash so far, don't start with this. Go back to the first issue. But
it's especially cool because there are multiple artists, but it feels intentional and it feels like they're all used for their specific skill set in the right place.
Yeah, Cy Spurrier is always very heady, but this feels the closest he's come to Grant Morrison, I think, in a comic book.
Yeah, that's a good
call. I say that complimentary. This is actually an advanced one as well, but Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Free Comic Book Day 2024 from IDW, written by Judy Ba and Paul Allure, art by Farrell Pei and Andy Kuhn. As usual with Free Comic Book Days, this is giving us a preview of what's coming down the road. Here it's for TMNT. You're not getting the Jason Aaron stuff, but you are getting Night Watcher, Night Smasher. I should have written this down.
Night Watcher, yep.
Night Watcher, who is a mysterious figure dressed in armor who seems to be the shape of a turtle and looks like a turtle, but who knows?
We don't know that, Alex. He might just have a very strong back.
He might. Whatever it is, this is pretty cool. This is basically like, what if a turtle was Batman in a mutant world? So that's super fun. And then we're getting another story in there as well. So I'm into this.
Yeah, I mean, it is funny reading this when we're on the precipice of a full reinvention of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where it's like, oh, this isn't that, but here's like sort of like, here's a couple appetizers, and it has appetizer energy, this book, because it is like a tangential book about this Batman turtle, and then it's just a fun story about what if Splinter like fucked around a little bit, what if he like played some video games and all that. But super reading the second story, though. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's very fun. It's very reminiscent of the animated series, something that doesn't often happen in a good way in the comics. It's also funny to me, it struck me that when we first come up on the scene, everyone's sort of doing their own thing. Donatello's doing machines. Raphael's punching a punching bag. Michelangelo's playing video games. And Leonardo is making pizza? Which I was like, hold on. They don't make pizza. They eat pizza.
Yeah, they don't know.
It was very weird to see him tossing dough. The idea that he's like making pizza. The whole thing is they get it delivered.
Yeah. Come on.
Or steal it or something. The fact that he's making pizza really took me, it took me a minute
to get it. It really took you out of the comic book?
I was like, if they make pizza, why do they ever need to go anywhere? The whole thing is they went to get pizza and they got seen.
Honestly, I just want to mention for anybody listening to the podcast, it is very easy to make your own dough. I usually once a month will make like a ball of dough, cut it into four parts, put it in the freezer, throw it in the fridge in the morning, grab some cheese, grab some sauce, some toppings. You're good to go for an evening dinner.
Wow. You're just really like walking us through the fucking barefoot Contessa over here. Like, you know how to make a pizza? Sauce and cheese? Wow, I've never cracked that recipe before. Thank you, Alan.
Man, I'm like a turtle or something.
Yeah, you're like a turtle, Batman. Pizza. You're like a turtle Contessa.
Anyway, this book is free, so pick it up this Saturday. X-Men number 34 from Marvel, written by Jerry Duggan, art by Joshua Cassara. We are getting to the end here. This is the second to last issue of this current iteration of X-Men. And in this issue, a lot of stuff goes down as the X-Men continue to fight Orcus. And everybody really pissed up with Charles Xavier. What'd you think about this one, Justin?
The I'm going to kill Charles stuff, I was mentioning this on the live show.
Yeah.
That in this issue only takes
a turn. Very cagey bouncing around it, I want to say.
Well, I just, this issue takes the crumbs that we were talking about and exponentially increases them. Where everyone's like, man, we ought to get that Professor X. And maybe we should kill him. And I was like, what is happening? I feel like the X-Men doth protest too much. Mm-hmm. They're going so hard at Charles Xavier, I feel like it's going to flip. But my favorite part about this issue is the way that Jerry's been weaving in this Sync Laura storyline and the fact that they went – oh, yes?
No, I have a question about that. Finish what you were saying.
Wait. The way that they went into an alternate dimension, essentially, and lived a life, fell in love. And then in a couple issues back – Laura died. And in this issue, another Laura, they are together, they meet up, and it's like a nice moment of a complicated story that is played really simply and sweetly, I thought.
Here's my question. Where did that other Laura come from? Because I was reading this and I was like, ah, yes, Laura and Sync. Hold on. I have a question here. Did I miss an issue or something?
When she died?
No, I remember her dying. I remember her being NSYNC's
brain.
NSYNC.
She was in NSYNC.
She was in NSYNC. And then she said bye, bye, bye.
Yes.
No, but she's in. I can't say it anymore.
She's inside NSYNC's brain. And he was trying to hold on to her.
Right. And then he let her go when it was beautiful and sad and whatever. Now she's back again. How is she back again?
I think the regeneration, the resurrection thing is happening again. So she was brought back in that way.
Oh, the White Hot Room or whatever?
Wherever the gang is that is doing that, they brought her back through that. Okay. It's just she didn't have that copy, that brain scan or whatever it was from before she went on the thing and fell in love with Sync.
Yeah.
So
that's confusing. That's, I don't know.
It's confusing, but it has been that way in X-Men continuity for years now.
Sure. It just felt like there should have been a little bit of establishment of like, oh, I'm the Laura from the White Hot Room who was resurrected or something. I don't know. I like all the things that are going on here. I like Joshua Cassara's art. I do feel like there's a little too much going on right now, and it's hard to concentrate on what's happening. To me, I don't know about you, but to me, it feels like the Kieran Gillen stuff is the main event, and everything else is just like stuff that's happening.
Oh, interesting. I have the complete opposite. I feel like the Professor X stuff is the main event, and the Kieran, all that other stuff feels like it's just a lot of mini battles where it's everyone doing stuff.
Huh. Well, that's the wonder of X-Men is that anybody can take anything out of it.
The idea that Wolverine's going to be like, you know who's crossed the line for the last time? Professor X, I'm like, dude, your whole thing is that. Why are you mad at him? You're like, I have to kill him?
Also,
I was like,
maybe stab the Sentinels? I don't know. Instead of Charles Xavier? Like, that should not be your primary mission right now.
Yeah. My goal? Kill my only friend and mentor. That ought to do the job. It's like, oh, okay. Weird take, dude.
Let's move on in our Duggan block to a advanced review. Falling in Love on the Path to Hell, number one. This is coming out June 5th, I want to say, from Image Comics. It's written by Jerry Duggan, art by Gary Brown. In this book, they're falling in love on the path to hell, you know?
Like, yes. Obviously, we don't want to say too much about it.
Yep.
The premise is fun, hyper-specific. There's a long history, I think, in the world of, like, what if an island just showed up? And that's some of what happens here. I'm definitely curious to read this. It's set up as a love story based on the title alone. We don't get much of that yet, so I'm excited to see how that comes.
I definitely have Shogun on the brain, but this felt 100%. A little bit like that just because we're getting, I'll say a spoiler here, but we're getting a cowboy and a ancient Japanese warrior. It seems like meeting up Samurai. In very strange circumstances. So there's a little bit of that going on here. Great art from Gary Brown. I'm really into this book. I'm very intrigued to see where it goes. It definitely is one of those Image books that's like, you want the premise? That comes at the end. Get ready for issue two. But worth picking up. Worth checking out. There you go. Agreed. Minor Threats, The Fastest Way Down, number two, from Dark Horse Comics, written by Patton Oswalt and Jordan Bloom, art by Scott Hepburn. We talked to the team on our live show a couple of weeks back, so check that out. But in this issue, we're getting a teen team is coming directly for Playtime while Playtime continues to spin out of control as secrets are about to come out. Here's something I want to throw out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Is this book becoming to The Boys?
Ah, interesting.
And for our listeners, the reason I ask is we're getting like this very extreme teen team of superheroes that is out of control and kills people and rips them apart. And it definitely like, I'm not sold on this, but I was definitely of a mind of, is this too much like The Boys in this issue? And I don't know.
I understand the comparison. I don't think, it's not giving that too much to me. I like this teen team of extreme teen team that is here. I think they're interesting. It's a nice corner of the minor threats world that we've been sort of introduced to play with, where the quote unquote villains are our heroes in this. So of course, a team of obnoxious kids heroes are great foils for them. I just love the little flourishes in this book. I think they're so smart. There's this thing where a spaceship crashed, and every year it releases a bunch of like lights, essentially, and it becomes this nice rallying point for everybody a couple times in this story. And I thought that was just really sweet and cool.
I agree. Great book, regardless of what I'm saying about comparisons to other books. Vengeance of the Moon Knight, number 5 from Marvel, written by Jen McKay, art by Alessandro Capuccio. We are getting two things going on here. One, Tigra and Hunter's Moon are battling the Shroud, who has been revealed to be the new Moon Knight. And 8-Ball is getting his own therapy session, as we've been getting every issue. If you read Blood Hunt, I think it's probably good to read this second, even though it technically takes place first, just because there's a big thing that happens here towards the end that ties into the event. This is really good. I really like just the mode of diving into the psychology of each of these characters every issue. It makes it very specific and interesting. I don't honestly know what 8-Ball is. That was one of the big things I was reading this issue. I was like, is he just a guy who wears a big thing on his head, or what's going on? But I still like that character anyway, so I don't know.
Well, and it seems like 8-Ball's taking center stage going forward in this comic. Yeah. So that's interesting. This is such a tonal difference from Jen McKay's other books. Like, this feels like it's a little darker, and it's a little bit more on the edges of we're all messed up, and here's how we just bang into each other in our lives. The essential thing of like Moon Knight, Hunter's Moon, Shroud, all these characters that look similar, are slightly different. There's a little bit of confusion there for me still in reading this. But I agree with you. It's a good story, and I like the way it's spinning directly into the Blood Hunt stuff.
DC's Spring Breakout, number 1 from DC Comics, written by Joey Esposito, Thomas Grzelczyk, Megan Fitzmartin, James Reed, Mike W. Barr, Patrick R. Young, Morgan Hampton, and Cameron Chittock. Art by Vasco Georgiev, Wes St. Clair, Gavin Guidry, Scott Collins, Kenya Danino, Nico Bascunian, Paul Perlerier, and Marco Santucci. This is all based on a very clear theme, which is spring break, I guess.
I would argue with that a little bit.
What's up?
I think there is a lot of spring break stuff in this, but there's also some stories I'm like, I don't know what this is about. That are good. There's a Lex Luthor being buried alive in a coffin bit.
That's what you do on spring break.
I guess that's
Have you ever been to Tijuana? That's like one of the main activities.
What's up, guys? I'm here at MTV Spring Break. We're doing the coffin break out here. Let's see if anybody can make it. I'm Eric Neese.
Third Eye Blind alive.
Good luck, guys. This semi-charmed kind of life is just less charmed than it used to be.
Yeah, this is, to your point, way less specific than a lot of the DC anthologies have been recently. I still liked a lot of these stories. I thought the Harley story up front was very fun. The Lex Luthor story was great, like you mentioned. But I don't know if whoever was in editorial was like, spring break. This is what happens in spring break.
Yeah, I mean, the one that I guess you could make a case that Lex is breaking out of a coffin, so it makes. But the Katana story, which I liked most of these stories, but the Katana one is just like a straight up regular Katana story.
There's the Superman story where he's like, I'm going to check out a baseball game, which to me is like, that's not spring. That's summer, maybe fall.
Spring training.
I guess. I don't know.
It's loose. And let me say, the cover is wild. The idea that we have Batman, Nightwing, and Katana hiking with sticks. Which is funny.
Yeah, I don't know. These anthologies are regularly pretty good, and I appreciate them as a tryout for various artists and writers. Not the best one they've ever put out.
but let me say, I guess the one of the stories that I really liked is the Batman Mr. Freeze story.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought that had a nice connection point and wrap up at the end.
There you go. Regardless, I think worth picking up just to support new writers and artists. What's the furthest place from here? Number 18 from Image Comics, written by Matthew Rosenberg, art by Tyler Boss. Big issue here. As we follow one of our main characters, we find out what's been happening with babies and her babies in particular in this post-apocalyptic world. We get a lot more on the strangers. And then in the second half of the issue, everything goes completely off the rails as we follow a bunch of things that are happening. Like, I really like this comic and I really like this team, but there's a point in this specific issue where I was like, oh, this is a really focused story they're telling. And then it starts jumping through a million things. And frankly, I had a hard time keeping up.
Well, I was like, agree. There's a pivot point where it's like, wait, what happened here? Where's the baby? And then we find the baby later. But I was like, how did she go from having the baby to not having the baby? And then the baby's over in another place. And a bunch of other people are hanging around. But so that was a little confusing, I agree. But the art in this is fantastic. This story is really, we're revealing a lot of things and we're sort of getting to the end potentially here, mm-hmm. it feels like. So like a lot of things are coming together. We're almost approaching the reason for the title, I think, here. And it's good, weird, interesting comics.
The Invincible Iron Man, number 18 from Marvel, written by Jerry Duggan, art by Chris Lee. In this issue, Iron Man is trapped inside of a giant Sentinel armor, and he has a team up with two of his biggest enemies that we all know. Fei Long and Magneto are both there, and ultimately they end up working together like best friends. Justin, what did you think about this one?
This is fun. Every time I read this, though, I wish White Queen was in it. That's just me. That's not a valid point of criticism. I just hope we're going to get back there. It's funny to see Magneto and Iron Man hanging out. They're a weird... I don't quite... Ironically,
We talked about this the last issue, and I had the same impression this issue where Iron Man's like, Magneto, one of my greatest enemies. And reading this, I'm like, is he...
Have you guys ever met?
I'm honestly not sure. Like, I understand the idea here, but I don't remember that. I've read a lot of comics.
Yeah, maybe too many. Let me ask you this. What's the deal with Mysterium? Because this comic is really pushing Mysterium as a cool...
This comic is really pushing Mysterium, and in this issue, spoiler here, but they get attacked by Nimrod, and they rip Nimrod apart. And I was like, wow, surprising to rip Nimrod apart in Invincible Iron Man 18, given he's kind of the big villain of this whole crossover thing. And they're like, well, that wasn't the real Nimrod.
Well, he moves by. He pulls an Ultron. He moves his brain okay. to another body.
All right.
That's how the internet works, Alex.
Sure. I didn't think that was the point of Nimrod, though. Like, I understand that's been going on in the background, but...
That's the big reveal in Crave, is that Nimrod's doing the app.
Oh, nice. I would love to tell Crave I would like to hook up with Nimrod.
You're like, oh, hello, I'm already right here. The Mysterium thing, because it's a metal that is more, it's like a living metal, I guess, that's stronger sure. than adamantium. And it feels like we're getting more about it. Like this comic, this issue is sort of about Mysterium at the end. In a weird way.
I don't know. This is a thing in comics and probably in all of fiction, frankly, but like this whole escalating thing with ongoing storylines where it's like, we introduced vibranium and accidentally adamantium at the same basic time. All right, they're even. Oh, now there's a stronger metal. It's called Mysterium and it can even break these things. And then there's going to be another metal that's called like, I don't know, Stronganium or whatever, and that's going to destroy
Alex,
that.
Let's take ownership of it. Zalbanium.
Zalbanium. Ooh, I like it.
Zalbanium.
That's really
catchy. I like
catchy.
The sound of that.
That's really catchy. I hadn't thought of that.
No one will ever defeat Zalbanium.
It's the same thing with Omega Mutants, where when they introduce that, I'm like, don't introduce that. Don't do that. Don't, like, rank the mutants. It's okay.
Well, they're very powerful. The Omega thing bothers me less because it's used as sort of like... oh shit, there's an Omega level mutant out there. It's like, it's more, less of a ranking and more of like, if you, once you break through into Omega, it's trouble. You get trouble.
But it's just, it's this temptation there where it's things like, oh, Iceman is also an Omega mutant because he can create ice dupes of himself and he's basically immortal and he can ice anything and create any ice structures he wants. And it's just like, I don't know, limitations are important for this stuff. There needs to be things that hamper people. If it's Spider-Man can do literally anything, there's no drama there because he can just punch his way through any villains.
I see. I mean, you're saying don't power up a mutant like Iceman to an Omega level mutant. Interesting take coming from someone whose favorite mutant is the least Omega level Cypher.
Yeah. He's a Zeta level.
Zeta, yeah.
Yeah. Toxic Summer, number one from OD Press by Derek Charm. This focuses on two dudes who just want to have the sexiest summer ever, and unfortunately, they get jobs at a beach that has become completely infested with toxic waste. Trying to have a good summer anyway. This is a delightful romp that slowly works its way into a monster horror story. Slight spoilers there, but super fun. Great art by Derek Charm. This is, as per his name, as charming as I wanted it to be. I had such a blast reading this book.
Really fun. And, you know, based on the what the book feels like as you're going through it, it has a real 80s movie energy, but it gets appropriately scary, I think, and, you know, horror-y. So I think it's a good, it's a nice ramp up into that. I'm looking forward to the next issue.
Character designs are great. I really liked the dichotomy between the main two characters as well. We've got our straight man, crazy man thing going on. Feels like you said, perfect classic 80s comedy in comic book form. The Incredible Hulk, number 12 from Marvel, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Nick Klein. In this issue, the Hulk is trying to get his friend out of a wooden doll. He's trying to find Doctor Strange to do that at the Strange Academy. It doesn't quite work out that way, and things get worse from there. Justin, what'd you think about this one?
How about the Strange Academy really setting itself up as a place? A book that wasn't the most popular, but I feel like the Strange Academy keeps popping up. Everyone thinks Doctor Strange lives there. I feel like I've seen that a couple times. That's the premise here. And I think that's a fun thing to be like, where can I find the president? I guess President Street's the most likely place. Let me go there. But I also just, the way that this book has become more horror, more body horror, while still maintaining and retaining the superhero bona fides of it, I like the way that it's also become the 12 labors of Hulk, but scary in a good way. It feels like he keeps going on. He's like, I have to get this woman out, this girl out of this doll. And it's the Dr. Voodoo really gets him here in a way that I thought was good.
Nightwing 2024, annual number one from DC Comics by Travis Moore. In this issue, we're getting the backstory of Bea Bennett, who is Nightwing's pirate girlfriend. I feel like we're going to have a little bit of a disagreement here because I know you really like this book, right, Justin?
You didn't like this.
I didn't like this.
Tell me why.
I didn't like this. I like the art. I like the idea of Bea Bennett. There is too much information in this book and too much time spent over the entirety of Bea Bennett's history throughout DC Comics. I'm forgetting which issue it was that we talked about earlier, but there was one that I'll scroll up while you're talking, but like there was one that, oh, the Phantom Menace one, actually, which is like, I'm sorry, but I think that's one that like gives a big span of history, but only gives us the information we need to tie into the emotional story it's trying to tell. This is full of pages that are just like, and then this happened, and this thing happened, and here's how this thing happened, and here we go. And then it's like slows down a little bit. There's too much of that. I would so much prefer something that is just focused on the emotional story of Bea Bennett, and that's it, rather than dozens of issues of history and summarizing.
I like the deep dive. This is a character that I haven't loved in Nightwing, but I thought this was a great. Really got to ride along with her, got to see the different ways that she's crisscrossed with Nightwing and all of his different iterations. I thought it was really nice. I thought the art was good, and I like the way the sort of emotional hits increase as the issue goes on, to the point that we get some big ones at the end.
All right. Big disagreement. Let's see if we agree on the last one. The Immortal Thor, number 10 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Carlos Magno. This is picking up after The Rocks and Thor, the one shot where Enchantress has created a fake version of Thor who loves corporations. Here, Thor is fighting The Rocks and Thor to see which Thor reigns supreme. This book is great. It has changed so much since the beginning, where it was about like Uber gods. And I assume we're going to loop back to that and weave everything together. But the parody that is going on here as Thor is corrupted by these action movie tropes and tries to suppress those urges. I honestly thought the satire was sharper in this issue than it was in the Rocks and Thor issue, which I was very surprised about.
I agree. I love that Thor is can't help but think of cliches to say. I thought it was such a funny idea. It worked super well to do the cliche, to have set up the cliche moment, hear him think it, and then be like, don't say that. I was like, I just loved that as a little comedic structure to this whole story. And the action's great, and we get a great reveal at the end. So this is it's a very surprising comic that it's working on all these levels while still being a great Thor story.
And if you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more, until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Oh no, his bones are made of Zalbanium. He's undefeatable. Alex.
And they fail.